I am happy to see you guys. What has been awesome in your lives?
I have one of those bittersweet ones, which is we finally started a bathroom renovation. So the awesome is what it's going to be like when it's done. And I'm enjoying all of the trials and tribulations that get you there right now.
Have you done this before?
I've done remodels before, yes.
So you knew what you were getting into.
It did. It's just, you know, trying to schedule people to come do work is not always the easiest.
I've never done a remodel, but when I listen to other people talk about it, I almost always have this idea pop into my head that it sounds a little bit like childbirth, that idea that, right? Like there's this pain that you kind of forget about and you like go back and do it again.
Each time you swear you'll never do
you're
it
like, again. You're like, never again. But, but it's this really great product at the end.
I'll let you use that as a very loose analogy that doesn't come anywhere close, but it's a concept, yes.
Yeah, we are, when I moved into this house 20-something years ago, it was a fixer-upper, and I don't have the fixer-upper gene. And once Dimitri was here and looked around and went, yeah, this isn't going to work. And he's got all the construction background. So we are in the process this year of maybe bringing the house up to like the 1990s.
A good decade.
It was an excellent decade. Yeah, we're having to, unfortunately, one of the things that happens in the desert is because two things. The groundwater is filled with all kinds of particulates. It's very, very hard water. And with Central Arizona Project, which came through bringing the water, piping it from the Colorado, loosened all of that stuff. Pretty much everybody who had galvanized pipes and houses that were built in the 40s and 50s is all galvanized. All the pipes are going. And so we're replumbing and building a laundry room. So we're like preparing to be right where you are, Justin.
Yeah. The biggest inconvenience is just, you know, we pretty much max out our house. So if we have to take away space for anything, which is what, you know, it's like we have to empty closets and bathrooms in order for this to happen. It's like, well, there's not really place for that stuff to go.
So you have no dining room table now, is what you're saying.
Well, it's more impactful on the bedroom than anything else. But, it, you know, it's just like, oh, gosh, I guess there was a lot of junk in that closet. Because when you have to put it all out here, it takes up a lot of space.
Good luck. Yeah. And you, Iffy, what's going on with you that's awesome?
I have simple awesomes today, and there's two. One being, I went to my daughter's track banquet last night, and today, which was fairly informal, but and today I revel in the fact that she literally grabbed me, her and her friend grabbed me and said, no, come sit with us. And so I got to sit at this table of teenage girls who like completely integrated me into their teenage girl conversation, which was lovely, including the many ways they were going to cheat their way through a writing project. But but I enjoyed that because I thought like, you know what? I have more time than I think that she's pulling me into the circle with her friends. So that I enjoyed. And I got new running shoes and just the greatest feeling in the world. the brand new cushioning of a new pair of running shoes. So. Those are my awesomes.
I wish I had prepared. I will, while we're talking, I will find this. My awesome, also a simple one. I'm pretty familiar with the birds in my neighborhood. I'm not a birder, but I like birds, if that makes any sense. I don't like do the count and do the, you know, the list and stuff, but I like birds. And I saw this bird caught my eye when I was walking yesterday, and it was bright, golden yellow. It's just one that I've never, ever, ever seen before and had to come home and look up. And I need to find a picture and show you guys, because it was just this. And you know, I walked in the house and was all giddy. And Dimitri looked at me and I said, okay, you won't be surprised at what I'm going to say, but I saw a bird I've never seen. And he just laughed. And then when I showed it to him, he went, oh my gosh. So I'll have to show you guys my bird. So that was my awesome. Is a, you know, when a bird can make you happy, I'm okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's spring here. It's just been really pretty. If he was asking me about the weather, and you know, for you guys back east, I told her I'm not going to tell you guys the weather.
Yeah, I'm just tired of the cold.
It's okay. We'll get our 4 days of nice weather, you know, before. Before summer hits.
Exactly. Right? 4 days.
Count them, relish them. I get it.
Yeah.
Totally get it. Yeah. I'm really, really grateful for the time, Iffy. This is
absolutely
really, really exciting. And you had asked in your email just a little bit about what we're trying to accomplish. And,
yeah.
I know that you know that we're sort of figuring out what the structure of creating the future is going to be moving forward. And one of the things that has been very attractive to us, because it fits so well into that structure, is moving away from the typical hierarchical board hires the CEO, hires very, very hierarchical. And moving towards a extremely networked platform with the deep intention that people doing the work have what they need to do the work. And knowing that really that's the only way that we're going to come anywhere close to accomplishing a huge mission in a very short amount of time is that people on the ground doing the work, whatever that work is, have what they need to do the work. Part of what they need to do the work is each other. So having hubs where they can come together, and whether that is each other for learning together, exploring together, discussing together, deciding together, and what they'll also need is resources. And so having mechanisms that we're still sort of figuring out, and we know that we'll probably know what they look like when we start building them.
Yes.
So like Justin's bathroom. that it will be sort of hubs and spokes and hubs and spokes and hubs and spokes. And at the center of all of it being whatever it takes to make sure that people can accomplish what they need to accomplish, all within the framework of catalytic thinking, because we know that if conversations and decisions are led by catalytic thinking, that will absolutely uphold our values. Hold the space for our values. So if every decision at every level, at every hub, every conversation is led by catalytic thinking, we know that our values will be put into practice. One of the things that people will need, like I said, is going to be resources. And one of those resources we are seeing is a board that keeps us legal. So rather than all of the patchwork that has been added onto boards over the years, when in actuality, the only thing a board really is the entity that the legal entity, stripping away all the patchwork, we're looking at a minimum viable board. There is a group in New Zealand and Spiral that is inspiring. The concept of a minimum viable board whose entire reason for being is compliance, is legal compliance. And we're sort of playing with, okay, what is that going to look like for creating the future? What compliance with what? I mean, at the core, the question is, the very, very bottom level question is, you know, what are we legally obligated to? And the delicious thing that happened about a month ago is Justin and I met with our attorney who said that there's nothing that we're talking about that scares her, and that She actually sees that this could be a cure for many of the ills that many of her clients face. So that's sort of where we're at. And Justin, I would invite you to fill in blanks from your perspective.
Well, if you had a chance to see the email that I sent you, Iffy, with just sort of some of the curiosity, I think, you know, the first disclosure is that Hildy has recruited a fellow pyrotechnic expert to blow this thing up. but in a very controlled and thoughtful
way. Mindful.
I mean, I will just echo a few things that Hildy said and I think drill down in a couple of spaces. But my general sense is of boards, the what I use now is a terminology. We've thrown together a hodgepodge of responsibilities and asked a potpourri of people to take care of them. And so we have boards that really, you know, there's this big list of shoulds, but really if we ask the question, who's in the best position to be able to do whatever that thing is, it's rarely the people that are gathered in the room. The biggest issue for me is one at the core of, you know, pretty much every legal document around corporations and trustees is they're supposed to put the interests of the organization first. And that's very broad, but my interpretation of that is, well, if it's the interests of the organization, ideally the interests of the organization are actually the communities that they're serving, the communities that they're trying to improve and create benefit within and create capacity for. And our boards basically have very little connection to that. I mean, the diversity issue, it's if we're asking the question, who understands best what it takes to create the change that an organization's mission advocates for, it's rarely the people in the room. And in fact, my own frustration has come out of being in those rooms of primarily white older people who, when asked that question, what would it take, have a real challenge understanding the realities that are on the ground. They have trouble understanding systemic issues. They have trouble understanding the assumptions and conditions that they get to take for granted. You know, so privilege begins to come into this. And so that frustration for me really just highlighted, like, it's the wrong people in the room, even for that basic fundamental piece. And then I do a lot of the financial piece, as we did with Panda's board. And again, realizing we're asking people to make judgments about things that they're really not prepared to do. It's just, we're not getting the best people to do that. And, you know, and then you kind of keep going down the list. You have, you know, CEOs and EDs, like yourself in your past iteration, who express a frustration because, you know, it's either, you know, the best boards are the boards that are strongly led by the ED. And it's like, well, okay, then do they really need to be there? Like if all they're doing is affirming decisions that have already been made, they're not contributing much capacity in that sense of the leadership and decision-making. They might be doing stuff. They might be raising money. They might be providing other resources and support. But again, kind of capturing that into this entity that's a board doesn't necessarily make sense. If you need people to fundraise, why do they need to be on the board?
Yeah.
You know, there's zero, I see zero connection. I mean, you know, it's, in fact, fundamentally, the vast majority of the organizations, their fundraising is not the board. So it actually demonstrates that the strength of fundraising has very little to do with the board. Anyways, sorry, I digress. So what? But all of that really did create this question, and I think in parallel with what's going on in creating the future, which is that catalytic thinking question, which is, there are these long lists of shoulds. There are these long lists of responsibilities, the roles and responsibilities of board members that truly, I think, have just been put into that bucket. And if we start asking the question again, as I framed for you, which is, you know, who's in the best position to do this? And you know, that question of legality and compliance and really unpacking that, like, why, you know, why do the statutes even require boards? What's you know, what are they trying to get at? What is it that they're trying to ensure, you know, legislatively by doing that in terms of regulation? And then asking the question, well, if that's the goal, if that's the desired outcome, who is best to do that? You know, when I do these financial pieces, you can hire all the auditing firms and you want. I will tell you, the single best auditor is your program manager who knows who the vendors are. I mean, that's your best audit. You want to find fraud and be transparent with your financials, with your staff, because they are actually the single best entity for affecting compliance. The audit, you know, Price Waterhouse isn't going to figure it out. somebody else is. And so I think there are lots of examples of that where, particularly even now that we've whittled it down to say, yeah, we already know there's a whole bunch of sort of qualitative pieces that can be shed from the board around mission, strategy, that really, you know, again, the competency isn't necessarily best. But even when we whittle down to the just thinking about legal and compliance, there is still this vast spectrum. And I think to build on what Hildy was saying with regard to the conversation with the attorney, I walked away basically saying, really, when you get down to it, there aren't any rules.
Right.
There aren't any musts. There aren't any givens. I mean, it's so broad. Trustees are supposed to act in the best interest of the organization. That's like what the statutes say. And, you know, and there are transactional things that the organization as a corporate entity has to do, like filing the 990 and, you know, some of the things that Arizona List had. But again, that's an organization entity compliance issue, not a, you know, governing legal body that actually has to do that. So that's where we are, and really thinking about, okay, if it is sort of this minimally compliant, and I think there's some transparency. We know there are some boxes we have to check off. Like, okay, like, let's do that. I think there are certainly external expectations around what a board is supposed to do, which we have to be able to address to ensure that capacity, that competency, that compliance is effectively happening within the organization. So it's not that we're just saying we're rid of the boards and because we don't like boards. It's saying, just as Hildy said, we have found a better way to ensure what boards were actually challenged at ensuring. You know, probably nine out of 10 boards, if you really ask them, like, do you know if your insurance covers all of your risk? They're probably going to say, I don't really know.
You know, if you have insurance, they will say, they will look at
yeah.
They don't know.
You know, do you actually, you know, do you fully understand why your programs are designed the way they are and the implications for community outcomes? No, but I know we do good work. You know, so
that's assuming that they could list three of their programs.
Yeah, well, and it's assuming that anyone has actually articulated that theory of change,
right. Yeah.
You know, clearly in the organization. So anyways, I mean, that's the space that we're in. And so I think the question that we're really asking, and certainly where your experience came up, I mean, not only the experience you have in the space as an executive director, you know, but also having recently spent time in this space of compliance.
Yeah.
I don't even know exactly what your job was. and we don't have to, but part of it is just sort of that thinking, like, what are you seeing? Again, you were embedded in this notion of compliance in some way, shape, or form. And just getting a sense of, you know, if we take away all the external expectations, if we take away all the rhetoric around it, I'm curious for you what you were experiencing and seeing sort of at the heart of some of this compliance, you know, I mean.
Sure.
As Hildy likes to say, it's actually the emotional side of, well, she hasn't said this explicitly, but I'm speaking on her behalf. It's about the emotional side of compliance, not the tactical side of compliance.
Yeah, because what I see is that there's, and again, it's the layers. It's the, at minimum, we need to be legally compliant. That is state and federal law. Okay. And as our attorney made very clear, as Justin was saying, there's very little positive thou shalt. There's a hell of a lot of thou shall not, but there's not a lot of proactive, this is what boards must do. So at minimum, there's state law and there's federal law. At the next level, there's IRS to maintain our 501c3 status. And at the next level, I'm seeing that there is general public foundation and donor expectations. Outside of that, I'm seeing there's lots of should type of organizations. There's Charity Navigator, there's Standards for Excellence, which in my experience, measure a lot of the BS that's been added on that Justin just so eloquently articulated. So as we're looking at what, at defining compliance, complying with whom we really need to versus whom everybody else says you should, because quite honestly, there's been a huge nonprofit industrial complex that's been built up around it.
Yeah. So, okay. So I'm going to start really quickly by saying, I should have mentioned, I have a hard stop at one. So if I don't get to something, interrupt me, or we'll definitely continue. So I just wanted to put that out there because I'm going to talk a little bit and like, you can be like, we get it, move on. What I am going to say is like, on a really basic level, you guys are on track. So from all the different seats as an ED, as a board member and sitting in compliance, yes, there's literally, and you know, right, all the nonprofit world will strike us down with lightning if they ever hear this conversation, right? So hopefully they don't find the recording. But there is a ton of should that is like just poured on. And like there's a piece where I can kind of get to, if I listen to, right, if we do what we listen do as listeners, right, and I listen to values and I listen to what people need, there's a piece of it that is just based on this idea of these organizations exist for the community and, right, we need to trust them. But in order to trust them, here are the 5,000 things that I need them to do for me to trust them, right? And that's part of what's been created, right? Somewhere over here, some nonprofit screwed up and the result was 5,000 new shoulds. And then somebody else screws up and then here are the, you know, and it makes the headline because we're dealing with public dollars. You know, it's somehow different when, you know, you see it happen on a corporate side and everybody like, right, everything gets dissolved, but people walk away with, you know, $1 billion packages. We kind of like sneer, but we keep moving. Over on the nonprofit side, we just think how appalling that that person did that. And there's some sort of moral trust that I think is part of what drives the reaction. And I think it is incredibly reactionary. And so there's a lot there. And so I did hesitate before I said the standards thing, because I thought I'm not really sure where you want to go. I will say, and I say this, I sit at Pano, Pano runs standards. I think there are benefits to things with standards in terms of helping organizations that don't know what they're doing learn. And it kind of gives them a framework within which to learn. You know, like creating the future, I think, is at a whole different place in terms of how you think and arrive and contemplate at and contemplate things that so many other organizations just aren't. And so it's kind of like, you know, has the potential to be really good training wheels for people until they get to that place where they're comfortable enough to really question. And that being said, you know, I don't think it's been, I don't think it's been run. It's not a program that's been run really well. I think if it had been, you'd see more organizations successfully moving through it, and you don't. There's a very small number of organizations in the grand scheme of things across the United States that have ever made it through the Standards for Excellence program. And frankly, most of them sit in Pennsylvania. So like, there's just something to be said for that. So like, you can take that and set it aside. What I do think is in standards, I will mention, is that piece around the external expectations. There are some pieces there that I do think you kind of have to grapple with as you're figuring out how you're going to move forward, and this idea of building public trust. Much of that, in my opinion, is addressed in terms of explaining how you're going to, you know, and I have this conversation a lot with people around the idea of a conflict of interest, If you can explain how you're addressing a conflict of interest, it no longer becomes, it's no longer an issue, right? And so there's a piece of being able, if you really know and understand, here's what it is, and this is how we're dealing and with it and managing it, not a big, it becomes less of a big deal. So all that to say, your lawyer's right. Like, there's like kind of your minimum. And, you know, I would say on a very, very basic level, you want to have, like, the IRS wants you to have at least three people on a board, right? Ideally, those three people should be unrelated. And I generally say to people, like, it's not worth it to talk your way through that. Just find three unrelated people. And if you don't know three unrelated people, like, rethink what you're doing. Because you're benefiting a community and you can't find three people. But if you find those three unrelated people and you try to avoid all those things that are as many of those things that are perceived conflicts, then you're good. Like, you've kind of met that minimum IRS requirement. There's a piece of, I think, how we structure nonprofits in the first place that is completely illogical. This idea of the board and ED and then staff, volunteers, whoever else, like, I don't know. It's like, it's worse than the Barbie doll shape. And we all figured out that Barbie would never be able to stand up if she was real. Right? Like, so it's just too narrow in the middle. And that maintaining that, you know, is just, there's like a level of insanity to what we've asked nonprofits to do in the first place. My gut is always, if you can minimize what's happening at the top, right? And I say that as president of the panel board, but if you can minimize what's happening at the top, but I know there's any number of things that we sit in the room and we don't, I couldn't tell you who carries our insurance. I trust Anne to know that, right? Like, there are pieces that I really think this is where those operations are. What's the role that you need me to play? To me, a minimum with a board that I think any board should have, and this is based on state and federal regulations, you want to have at least your three people, and you want to have a president, a secretary, and a treasurer. And that's really based on if you're doing work in other states, and I think Creating the Future could very easily get to that point where, right, if you're not there already in terms of you're operating in other states and need to meet those state regulations, the fact that you're operating in other states, generally what comes up on paperwork, and it varies state by state because that's the beauty of states' rights, is that nobody's consistent, is that somewhere somebody's going to ask for a president's signature or a treasurer's signature. Those two come up the most frequently. And a lot of places, a lot of states want to know that you have that secretary who's keeping minutes. That being said, one of the resources that I could share, it sits on the Harbor Compliance website. So it's all, and there's a ton on that site that's available for free, but is a nonprofit governance by state chart that literally outlines here are the requirements by each state. And a lot of them say you just need one director. The issue is that when you hit that federal level, IRS wants to see three. So that's why I always say have the three. If you tag a president, a vice president, a treasurer, and a secretary, and you can get creative with the titles, but you got to be able to draw a line for several states to a president, secretary, and treasurer. So I don't think the creativity makes a lot of sense. Then you are generally going to be covered in terms of what's required in any state when you decide, okay, we're going to operate here, we're going to fundraise here, whatever it may be.
And I think, and just as a quick interruption, many of those statutes don't even require that those officer positions be held by board members.
Right.
They actually can be, long as, you know, I mean, most corporations actually have a paid corporate secretary. You know, and a corporate treasurer.
A lot of them don't require that they be held by board members. Where you get into the issues again is this idea of conflict of interest, that, you know, you have people sitting on your board who should be involved in setting a budget and setting salaries. And now you're setting salaries for yourselves And we created these community organizations and these public charities to take on public dollars. And we want to know that you're not doing that for your benefit. And that's all where, that's where it comes down. Like, that's where it gets messy. So can you, if you can explain that in a way that is, you know, meets everybody's satisfaction, that's great. At the same time, this is, and again, this is where that external perception starts to come in. The reality is we look at boards where everybody's paid on a nonprofit and we question it, right? So, you know, there's like, if you can find the people who are willing to do it without getting paid, there's something to be said for like the ease of that versus, you know, having these be paid positions. You know, this is where I think you start to get into like the really great boards are the ones that have strong EDs. They're very staff led, right? Where I have a treasurer, but my treasurer knows like everything's coming from my finance person, right? They're not in the, like, they're not in the database. They're looking at, they're not looking at the numbers. There's so much coming from the internal system. You know, they maybe have some sort of oversight. They're maybe looking, they're somewhat aware, but that day to day is absolutely sitting inside those staff positions. So it be, it does become one of those things like, really, what is a treasurer doing?
Well, it's the absurd emperor's clothes thing that boards lead and run organizations.
Yeah.
And there's not a living soul in the world who believes that.
Yeah.
And you can have all the shoulds you want, but how much time do staff people spend preparing the board to say the things that will give the perception that they're leading?
Yeah.
I'm curious, sort of iffy as you were talking, because one of the things, you know, you talked about the salary issue and the trust issue. And I know this goes back to some of the root of creating the future, which is transparency. You know, you've heard the statement, you know, the best way to deal with equity issues in pay is be transparent of pay.
Yeah.
It will reveal it's, you know, so the notion that the board needs to approve the pay of, you know, the executive and the salary structure, again, is a construct of which is, it's secret. So we need to make sure that there's somebody who's ensuring that what's secret is, you know, all copacetic. And if we take that away, I mean, if we just have salaries are based on market rates of comparable to, you know, positions and, you know, seniority up to a certain number of years or whatever it is, I mean, we put it out there and we say, that's what the, you know, here's what the salaries are. We don't need a board anymore. I mean, the compliance comes from the, just as I said, just as you were saying, which is that sense of trust that, you know, people are supposed to approve that. Well, again, it's a question of whom is it, whom are we approving it for and to what ends? And if the approval is to ensure trust, again, in fact, the system doesn't do that because it's not transparent. All we have is the and, you know, I love this idea of, I mean, so the hypocrisy of which we all live in. So, you know, I do a lot of financial leadership training. And I do talk about approving a budget, but I never actually talk about the board approving the budget anymore. Because I'm like, what, or the board approving financial statements. I'm like, what are they approving? Are they approving that the numbers add up correctly? Are they, you know, and so we sort of talk about, you know, the budget, like what people need to approve is that resources are being used in the most effective and efficient way possible to deliver upon our mission. Whether that happens in 12-month chunks, 24-month chunks, 36, you know, monthly, whatever it is, like that's the functional thing that we need to happen, and then it needs to be demonstrated and monitored that's there. But it strikes me that some of this is really, yeah, deeply around the fact that there's a lack of transparency that forces the board to be an intermediary to manufacture that trust.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's like this like kind of crazy irony to the sense, to the idea that, you know, we created these organizations that, you know, we're going to trust more than anything else, except we don't really trust them. So you have this oversight body. And again, partly it's because, right, we're taking in public dollars, and there's some sense of like the public is giving us money. So we have to really make sure that we're we're stewarding that money well.
It is, rooted in such, I mean, it's so, you're talking, and I have to say, my skin is, I can just feel everything going, because it is so rooted in the exact opposite of what we're about. It is so rooted in suspicion and assumption that you're going to fuck up. So somebody's got to make sure that when you do, somebody else knows about it, because we know you're going to do it.
And yeah.
It's rooted in the fact that nonprofit organizations, for the most part, are corporations, and corporate boards came from that entire thing. We know somebody's going to screw up, so at least somebody's there that's representing supposedly the owners.
Well, and we've gotten to this place where, if some other for-profit business somewhere along the line screws up, I care a little less, because they produced like a widget, or they produced a pizza, or they produced whatever, or frankly, we've already decided that as much as we really admire and want the same level of income that they may all have, like, they're bad anyway. So we've set the expectations really low, right? Whereas anybody who's a nonprofit, we must be there because we are like these inherently angelic people who will never make a mistake and will never screw up. And so when we do, like, our entire world shatters because, somebody got $100,000 in salary, which you only do over there. Over here, you have to be broke and just doing it for the good of the world. But so I think that there's that piece of just balancing that external expectation. And again, I think it's being able to speak to it. And it's, that's where some of the challenge may come in terms of how you talk to the public and how you talk to the other group will be, right, the foundation world.
Right.
As you go out and you talk to the foundation world, I think there are foundations that a growing number of foundations that are starting to question how things have been done. But there's a lot of tradition in the foundation world in terms of, here's the checklist of what everybody needs. And it's been more recently that people, like foundations, I think, have started to figure out, like, sometimes people have that entire checklist and yet they're really not very impactful with anything that they're doing. We need people to like work a little creatively, or, we go to these other countries around the world where we've decided that we are going to have this incredible impact, and lo and behold, they know better than we do, but they don't have boards and 990s and, that whole checklist of things. So we have to start investing a little creatively. And I'm curious to see what happens, because I think Charity Navigator is one of the many that are talking about how they're going to start measuring impact. And I read it and I was kind of amused, because I was like, I don't think you know how to do that. I'll be curious to see like what metric you've come up with on a 990 that measures impact, and how quickly we'll all learn as nonprofits how to move our numbers around so that we show impact. But
even if on the 990 there was a question, and again, this is so unrelated to what boards legally need to do, but if on the 990, not board, but is there an annual discussion of what impact looks like? Anywhere. Just check the box, yes or no. I'd love to see. One of the things that I'm getting from the conversation is that there are things, a list this big of stuff that, whether legally or IRS, which is basically our existence, wants to see. And that list is this long. And I count IRS as any checkbox you do need to fill in on the 990. Do you have a conflict of interest policy? Check. Those kinds of things. Including anything that you might have to fill in if you were applying new, and if something happened, they would come back and say, okay, do you really have this? In every other, and one thing that I did get from what you're talking about, Iffy, is so it's not just federal and state law and the IRS, but also the requirements in other states. So those are the minimum legal that are occurring to me. The other thing that's occurring to me, including the setting of salaries, including, I was scribbling down, insurance and risk management, including those kinds of pieces, is I think there is, and Foundation's expectations is coming into my mind for this, if we can say there is a mechanism, and here's what the mechanism is, which gets to what Justin was saying, if we can say, yes, absolutely we have that, it's not here, it's here.
Yeah.
And here's how it works, and what do you think? And they go, ooh, that might be better for us. But I think that there's those two different things. Is there a mechanism to deal with the expectations, and is there the minimum legal stuff?
Yeah, I think that you have a lot, of flexibility. You know, I think, my experience with foundations is that there were the foundations out there that wanted to know that my board was aware of things. What I can tell you is, my board was unaware of a lot, like including all the foundations I was applying to. maybe we kind of gave them a list, a little like, hey, this is what we did in fundraising this year, and this is where we're applying. And when I say we're targeting this number for next year in terms of revenue generation, it's based, this is how we've built up to that number. So maybe they had that picture. I don't think anybody retained it. Nobody would have been able to come back and spew it later if they were asked. And frankly, in my opinion, it's operational. When, you know, we look at stuff for Pano, and we just did this because we're going through standards reaccreditation for Pano, like it's mind-numbing, the stuff that the board is supposed to be approving and accepting. And frankly, I want no part of it because I don't want to tell them how to go do their job. Like, what do I know? And have really tried to take the position of, you know, we can work with you in terms of revenue generation. What's the easiest thing for us to do for you? Right. Where it's not creating more work for you. You're not suddenly like guiding me, teaching me, you know, like what's the thing that you want to spoon feed to the board and we can go do this. And it's literally whittled down to membership calls. Hey, we saw your membership lapsed. There's a script. There's a like here. And literally the last email I got from Ann was like, you have one call to make. And still it's sitting in my email, but... But
I've got a question. When you see whether people are coming to Pano for this, because I can see both of your hats being mm-hmm. really, really helpful here, whether people are coming to Pano for this or the things that you're encountering from your position at Harbor Compliance, what are the things that people get in trouble for the most?
So honestly, the things that cause the most trouble are when boards and staff cross lines. And this was my experience at a woman's place. It's ironically still the experience of, like, there's a piece of what's still happening at a woman's place. What's been interesting for me is being out of a woman's place, I get board members calling me all the time asking about their role in some incident that's occurred. And I've said, like, you mucked it up when you got involved in the first place. Like, get out.
What about legal issues?
Yeah.
What are the legal issues that people come and say, Pano, help me, I've got this thing? Or Harbor Compliance?
Yeah. A lot of it is, like, you know, there's the, it's all the stuff that you're talking about. There's that risk management, insurance, like, you want to have that stuff in order. And again, I don't know that a board needs to do it.
Right.
Right. I think it's good if a board knows that it's done, but the board doesn't need to do it. People knowing, here are the reports that need to be filed. So, and this is where, in terms of Harbor Compliance, the cleanup that we often do is around whether or not an organization's missed an annual report that's due, whether they have or haven't registered to fundraise in a state, whether or not they've renewed that registration, because sometimes they don't, you know, they're, again, states' rights, it's a beautiful thing. Sometimes it's annual, sometimes it's every 2 years, whatever it may be. Like, those are, you know, the people who need to remember, you file a 990 every year. I don't care if you feel like you didn't make enough money. like you do some version of it so that the IRS doesn't shut you down. Like those are the big pieces. And what I will say in terms of some of that, again, a lot of it, I don't think needs to be done by a board. Right. Board member is going to sign off. And if you have a decent board member, they are glancing at least at what you're asking them to sign. Right. So they're going to sign off and, you know, you run into banks that want to know, hey, I have a board member involved, that kind of thing. There's some sense that the boards hold that power that you still have to kind of deal with. California, and I want to say it was last year, changed some of their rules and regulations around their laws around fundraising registration and to shift accountability to board members. And so when they ding states who've not registered and there's some sort of penalties assessed, they have the ability to go back and make board members pay it personally and not have it come out of a general fund. That's not happening necessarily across the country. California did that. And so like that's where to me things shift, and I don't want my board involved in the day-to-day management of my fundraising registrations, but as a board member, you want to know that they've been taken care of. Like there's kind of just, and so I do think there are things that you can kind of, and again, a lot of those, like, you know, depending on the size of your staffing and the structure of your staff versus the structure of your board, someone's signing some piece of paperwork somewhere.
There's so many things that are popping into my head now. So what you were just describing, Iffy, is a really interesting, I think, conundrum here, which is the construct of the board is that it's an independent body that signs off that those things have been done. So what it is it's not just that it has been done, but there is a sign off from someone independent, someone who doesn't have a confluence. It's really actually someone who in some ways doesn't have a confluence of interest. You know, ironically, it's like someone who has nothing to benefit from this being in compliance is the one who should be checking to see whether it is compliant.
Some of it is, right, this idea of, is coming back to this idea of, we're expecting this body of people to make sure that this body of people behaves properly.
Yeah, and there's, like now then in that so many layers, which is all of these shortcuts that we've tried to create the trust that you opened with, which is by having the board sign off on it, the funder now doesn't have to do their due diligence. What we've done is we've basically put all these layers on as shortcuts, mm-hmm. as proxies. And we've layered it so much, you know, that the proxies actually have no authenticity in what they are ensuring in that, you know, how, you know, an actuarial is the only person who's really going to understand whether your insurance fully covers the risks that you're, okay. Probably 99% of board members are not actuarials. So even if they have the insurance in front of them and the ED says we have it, we still have no assurance that it's actually the right kind or we've done this whole proxy system again to alleviate the need for due diligence. Like I was imagining, you know, with just what you were saying about the foundation, you know, I always think about these wonderful passive aggressive questions, which is, you know, hey foundation, is it your expectation that every single one of our board members knows that we're talking to you about this grant? You know, And my guess is that most foundations would say no, that's kind of unrealistic, you know? And it's like, okay, but what are all the things that you ask us for that are absolutely perfectly analogous to that, that you're asking the board members to know, which, okay. You know, is just as ridiculous a question to ask.
And again, I think that you know, we could go down a million rabbit holes, and I want to be really mindful of if he's time. I think that what I'm sensing, Justin, is that having the conversation, and it's not just going to be before we flip the switch. I think this is going to be probably a year or two's worth of conversations of, okay, what are the mechanisms? We get what the board is going to be. But now, what are going to be the mechanisms that will ensure all of those other things? What are the HR mechanisms? Because, you know, D&O and E&O off insurance companies will tell you that the thing that organizations get sued for the most is employment. So where, you know, it was always my favorite question when I was a consultant, I would ask groups, you know, what do you think is the thing that they get sued for the most? And of course they all said embezzlement. And it's like this big. It's like, yeah. No. There's two big things that insurance companies will tell you. One is employment and two is failure to pay payroll taxes.
Yep.
And those are the big ones. And so again, I'm looking at all of these sort of buckets that if we're going to have professionals who actually know what they're doing, help guide those pieces, because those are also going to be, when it gets down to who's in the field and knowing that they're covered, knowing that when I go out to do my work, I've got everything I need. Part of what I need is to know that everything is legal, that when I go out and tell a foundation, yeah, we've got a 501c3 that we actually do, somebody's covering that, somebody's making sure it's there, somebody's making sure we've got insurance, et cetera, et cetera. And seeing that, having conversations around what are those buckets, and in each of those buckets, having conversations to say, okay, what will it take to ensure that things are moving where we want them to be? What does this risk management bucket make possible, rather than how do we make sure everybody doesn't screw up?
Yeah.
Really using catalytic thinking to walk through all of these mechanisms could be actually really fun for stuff that is usually really boring.
Yes. I know Shiva and I at one point talked about using catalytic thinking, and we were going to get together and do this for fun. So we're nerds, around conflict of interest, because conflict of interest is inherently like fear-based. There's no trust in it. And, you know, like it's right. It's the most ironic, one of the most ironic policies that I've ever seen. But, so she and I kept talking about like, hey, we should play around with this at some point. We just haven't gotten to it.
Oh, take a look at someplace back in the annals of our blog. Is the conversation that our board had around conflict of interest way back when we were first filing for our C3. And the conversation was so deeply rooted in, don't you want people to have, as the exact word that Justin said, don't you want people to have a confluence of interest? And isn't that what we want?
Yeah.
And
so the other thing that I will say that is important to keep in mind, and this kind of goes to the, like, I would revisit this repeatedly along the way, is that when things come up, people look at the bylaws, right? Right? And so what I often tell, especially when I've worked with new formations and, you know, they're agonizing over all the potential what ifs that may occur somewhere down the line, is like, you pull out your bylaws and you consistently look at them, because the expectation is that you are going to follow what is in your bylaws. And if you're not following what's in your bylaws, then you need to have a conversation about, is there a reason why? Is it that the bylaws aren't the best way for us to do this? And if not, change them. So that, because the IRS gives you a ton of leeway. They want you to have bylaws. They give you all sorts of space as to what's in them. And so ultimately, you want to make sure that if you've come up with a best practice and it's not captured in your bylaws, that you change your bylaws to do that. So I would.
What we've been talking about with our bylaws is that our bylaws will be one paragraph, and it will say, when any question comes up about anything within Creating the Future, we will ask the following questions in the following order.
Yeah, because that's what people go back to. Like, you know, and when you see the issues come up, a lawsuit around whatever maybe happened on a board and between the board and the staff, you know, God help me, membership organizations where members, like, for, you know, conduct some sort of coup and they take over because I didn't like you, so I just found 500 of my closest friends to pay $10, become members, and I ousted everybody, which I find entertaining but terrifying at the same time. Like, right? It's because that's what it said in the bylaws.
So, again, I really want to be mindful, because you've got a hard stop in about a minute.
Yes.
And if we sort of take a deep breath here and your overall reflection, your overall impression?
I think you guys are on the right track. I think it's really, really exciting. And I think you have a lot of leeway. So explore everything. There's actually very, very few rules out there. There are the places that you'll run into stuff, and I'm happy to have other conversations. I think your biggest thing to be mindful of is when you're doing work in other states, because that's absolutely your intention. So you're doing work in other states, you're fundraising in other states, all of that. That's what you need to be mindful of.
Yeah, and the interesting thing being so online is that interpretation of working in other states is real simple. Oh yeah, well, you've got somebody taking a class and then you're working in our state. And I think that's
yes. Something
that we have
and, to be mindful. States' rights. They all get to decide how they feel about it.
Yeah. Justin, your thoughts?
I appreciate, if you just in listening to you, some of that clarity around the trust, the transparency, this idea of the shortcuts and the proxies, and in really recognizing those are kind of the core issues we need to tackle. It's not the tactics of it or the compliance of it. It is that external perception. And what excites me is there's a way to do that that's so much better than what we are doing right now. I mean, so much more effective than the current system at actually accomplishing those goals. And it would not require this structure that we keep trying to create.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will add, I think as you come up with ways to deal with something, put a devil's advocate in the room. Like literally find that person who's going to tear it apart and question everything and be like that the person who lacks any trust of you whatsoever. And then you figure out how you answer the question.
Right.
I like it. My reflection is a combination of excitements. One is the excitement at what is possible, because I really do think blowing this up and starting over is just with a different set of questions, with a what will this make possible, is exciting. The other thing that I'm deeply excited about is any conversation where a bunch of geeks is getting together talking geekily about this stuff is way too fun. So I'm grateful to both of you.
Thank you. This was fun.
Right.
And again, find me if you have any other questions. I'm happy.
Sounds great. Bye-bye.
Great. Thanks, Ippy.
Thanks, you guys.